I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:36 p.m. on Tuesday, March 10th, 2026. Present today are Representative Vallard, Representative Staff, Representative Hannon, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Bynum, Representative Galvin, Co-Chair Schrage, and myself, Co-Chair Josephson. We've been joined by Co-Chair Foster. So we have just about everyone here. Also present today are House Finance Committee staff, Committee Assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Tallulah-Lastufka, Secretary Bree Wiley, and Secretary Leah Frazier. We also have our moderator, Emily Mesh, from the Legislative Information Office. Before we start, please mute your cell phones. In today's meeting, we will finish hearing House Finance Subcommittee closeout reports. Then we'll take up House Bill 280, Apportionment of Taxable Income, Digital Business. The following closeout reports being presented this afternoon are for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. We've been joined by Representative Jimmy. So DCCED, the Legislature, the Office of the Governor, and the Department of Revenue. If Mr. David Jang will please come forward and put himself on the record, he can begin his presentation and close out a report on the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Mr. Jang.
Good afternoon, members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is David Jang, staff to Representative Elise Galvin. The House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, or DCCED, submits the following recommended operating budget for FY27 to the House Finance Committee. The recommendations from the subcommittee by fund source are, and members can see this on the front page of the budget action report, $17,956,000 in UGF, $69,779,200 in DGF, $66,784,100 in other funds, and $42,673,800 in federal receipts, for a combined total of $197,193,100. Compared to the FY27 Governor's amended budget proposal, subcommittee recommendations increase UGF by $2,100,000, or an increase of 13.2%, and decrease in DGF by $2,100,000, or a decrease of 2.9%. DGF, resulting in net zero change in funds. There are no changes in other funds or federal funds. Members can also see the number and types of positions in the subcommittee recommendations, and they are the following: 573 permanent full-time positions, 0 permanent part-time positions, and 23 temporary positions, for a total of 596 positions. The House Finance Budget Subcommittee for DCCED reviewed the FY27 budget request and adopted all but one of the governor's requests. Referring to the budget action report, here are the following modifications and additions. You can see the governor's items in black text and items added by the subcommittee are in blue. First, I will highlight the major items here accepted without changes from the governor. Item 12 on page 4 shows an increment of $2,238,800 UGF to restore the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation's annual operating costs. This is a one-time increment that has come before and passed the legislature every year. Item 14 on page 4 shows a fund source change from $923,500 UGF to $923,500 AEA receipts. The fiscal note for House Bill 307 used general funds for the initial setup of the Rail Belt Transmission Organization, also known as RTO, which were replaced by Alaska Energy Authority, that is AEA receipts, in FY27. Item 15 on page 4 shows an increment of $1,306,200 UGF for the Rail Belt Transmission Organization RTO to give stopgap funding for the Alaska Energy Authority to pay for the legal and administrative costs needed until the Regulatory Commission of Alaska finalizes the open access transmission tariff. Once this tariff is finalized, AEA's administrative costs will be recovered from the electric utilities. Now I will cover the items that were changed and modified by the subcommittee. Item 4 on page 2. There is a wordage change. The word federal was removed from the new carry-forward language for collected receipts under the Alaska Broadband Office. This action is technical as the Alaska Broadband Office spends CIP receipts in their operating budget as opposed to federal receipts. Item 9 on page 3, subcommittee revised by changing the fund source. This is a transfer from professional licensing receipts to business licensing and corporations receipts. And the subcommittee changed the business licensing and corporations receipt, which is a DGF fund source, to unrestricted general funds, as well as reduce the allocation by 50%. The governor's original proposal transferred $4,200,000 from the professional licensing receipts fund, or fund code 1156, to business licensing and corporations receipt, which is fund code 1175. Both of these are general fund program receipts. This is to support investigations of misconduct and fraud among non-compliant licensees. The subcommittee concurs with the governor's intent to distribute investigation costs more broadly and reducing investigation cost burdens on professional licensees. However, the subcommittee modified the proposal by replacing GFPR with UGF, noting that the use of GFPR would function effectively as an indirect UGF appropriation without the transparency associated with direct UGF funding. Furthermore, the subcommittee reduced the funding level for noncompliance investigations from $4,200,000 to $2,100,000 in recognition of the current fiscal constraints. That concludes my closeout report for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And I thank the committee.
We have questions first from Rep. Hannon, then Rep. Allard. Rep. Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Ms. Young, my question is about the item 10, the licensure investigations. So if we're only transferring half of what the department requested, and my recollection from the department overview was that was the dollar amount that the average year's investigations were. So and the investigations are currently funded out of professional licensure fees. So if it costs more than $2.1 million, if it costs $4 million, the remainder funding will come out of its traditional location of program receipt monies, or will we not investigate beyond $2.1 million?
If you know, Mr. Jiang, if you need assistance, we have that for you.
Yeah. Through the chair to Representative Hannon. First off, I just want to correct, it is indeed item 10. I mentioned item 9 on the record. So this would be item 10 on page three. As for the funding and cutting this allocation by half, I would like to bring up legislative fiscal analyst Rob Carpenter, if I may, through the chair.
I think you may, Mr. Carpenter. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, Rob Carpenter, Legislative Finance. To the question, Representative Hannon, the original intent of this action was to replace all of the investigative costs, which range about $4 million. With another funding source, the subcommittee replaced half of that, so the remainder would still be funded with the professional licensing receipts.
Follow-up, Rep. Hannon.
Thank you. My understanding, Co-Chair Josephson, is that those professional licensure receipts are allocated to each board. And one of our issues, as we've discussed, about multi-state compacts, so some of those licensure boards now have fewer people paying in. I'm going to just choose social workers because it's a fairly small number. So will it come out of general program receipts, or does it still go back to the individual board of, say, social workers? And if they don't have the program receipts because we don't have enough social workers paying the licensure fees because now they're all multi-state licensed, does it go to other boards, or is all of that money from all the professional licensing boards commingled into one fund and it doesn't matter? It's just it matters to the accountants, but it doesn't matter to the overall budget.
Mr. Carpenter.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hannon, it's my understanding that the particular license would have to pay for the investigative costs of their license. However, if there's a shortfall in a particular year, I know Commerce tries to average out the costs over multiple years. So they do have carry forward receipt authority. I imagine they backfill with other licensing receipts, and then they even it out over the years. Is I'm pretty sure how they've operated historically. So, yes, the individual licensees pay for it, and it's theoretically averaged and backfilled where necessary with other licensees' revenue.
Mr. Chairman, since we have our state auditor, or the legislative auditor, I'm trying to figure out whether she keeps such a good game face, whether this is, because you might recollect when we get those audits of these licensing boards, there are generally some very specific controls. So I'm trying to figure out if this is all good and we're still going to have investigations, or whether this is going to create an audit nightmare in the next cycle over investigations.
Ms. Curtis, would you help us with further questions? Ms.
For the record,
yep.
I'm Chris Curtis, your state auditor. The law, the statutes require that each board licensing fee be set at a level that covers the cost of regulating the profession. That's a policy decision that came out of a big council that was created in 1992 of how these boards and the funds were going to work. So that was a big policy decision back in 1992. I'm unaware of this decision. So historically, when we're doing a sunset audit, we do check the board's surpluses and deficits to make sure their licensing fee has been set at a level that covers the cost of regulating the profession. So I'm unclear how this will factor in and how that impacts the law that's currently on the books about how fees are to be set.
Rep. Allard, then Stapp.
Thank you, and through the chair. So I know we have a lot of vacant positions, but I was just trying to figure out, I have my book, and if my staff's listening, they'll bring it, but we have vacant positions within Commerce, but we're adding two full-time positions. So I'm trying to figure out why. I can't remember.
I think that's directed to Mr. Jang.
Yes, Mr. Jang. Okay. I'm sorry, I couldn't remember your name. So I'm just trying to figure out why we're going to add two more positions, and I'm pretty sure we have vacancies when they're. Why can't we just have them do it? Why aren't we using individuals to reallocate it?
Mr. Jang, if you have an explanation. First, is she right about that? And second, do you have an explanation for it?
I am.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, if I may, if I can ask which item you're referring
to. Oh, I apologize. So I guess it would be number 5 on page 2. Mm-hmm. And it was for the federal disaster for grant management. I guess so we have more individuals that can do the grants. I'm just trying to figure out, since we have the vacancies, why are we adding two more? Why can't we just fill those with the individuals that can do grants?
Through the chair, through Representative Allard, I don't have an answer for that question. I would see if legislative fiscal analyst Rob Carpenter would have an answer.
Okay. If we only knew where he was.
Okay. Yeah. Can you find him for us?
Yes. Mr.
Thank you.
Sorry, Coach Josephson, just a quick question. Since this is an item from the this is a request from the administration. Mr. Carpenter the best person to address this, or would it be better to have OMB?
That's a fair question.
Know. If he knows the answer, I'm good.
Through the chair, this is Rob Carpenter, Legislative Finance. I think conceptually you're asking, I don't know the details of the vacancies within Commerce at the moment, but conceptually you're asking why wouldn't they use a vacant position, transfer it from another division, and fill it. That conceptually is possible for them. I think from an agency standpoint, they're trying to fill those positions, and if it wasn't if it was a position they wouldn't need, they would either decrement it or possibly transfer it. In this case, they did not do that. These are two new positions as a result of these federal grants that are requiring a large administrative burden.
May I?
Yes. I'm just hesitating because, as the co-chairman said, the OMB or ASD for this department would be the expert in the motivation. But please go ahead.
Okay. So it appears we have 67 total vacancies within Commerce. So I think that later maybe the committee could address that. I'll get a follow-up. I'll figure it out, and we'll get somebody else in here to answer it, of why they're doing that if we have 67 vacancies within that division or department. Thank you.
Rep. Stepp, then Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Justin, through the chair to Mr. Young. Thanks for being here. Always appreciate staff work on subcommittee. I am having a hard time understanding what exactly we are doing with item number 10. I will kind of piggyback on what Representative Hannon was talking about. So if the license fees are supposed to cover the regulating of the profession and the professional license investigations as part of regulating their profession, and we're going to replace their program receipts with general funds, are we going to lower the cost of their licenses to meet our guidance? And do we know that through the chair?
So just going down the row here, that would not be Mr. Jang Lane. It might be something Ms. Curtis would speculate on, but I think this is a new concept, and so we haven't had cause to lower licenses before due to this particular UGF replacement. Do you want to comment on it, Ms. Curtis?
Through the chair, Chris Curtis, legislative auditor. There has been many movements over the years, some committee meetings, discussions on taking out investigations out of the current fees cover the cost because it can create highs and lows. And it's hard for licensees to, immediately double their fee or whatnot. And there's a lot of complaints from constituents, that type of thing. That hasn't been done. I know they've had bills to change and pool the type of cost so it was more fluctuated across. But right now, I don't believe there is a change to the actual law right now that covers fees. So if you reduced the cost of the occupation, then it would reduce the fees.
My fault, Mr. Coacher.
Yes, but that begs a question. You said it would reduce or it could reduce? I mean, who would be the decider, to use that term?
Through the chair. The law has not been changed, so the law says that the fees should cover the cost of regulating the profession. So if the cost goes down, the fees would go down.
Okay.
You're basically supplanting the license fees with general funds.
Thank you. Rep. Stepp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Justin. Through the chair, this is going to be to Mr. Carpenter. Second line of thought here. Where do the license fees go? Do they flow into the general fund if we are taking too much? Basically, that covers the cost, through the chair.
Mr. Carpenter.
Through the chair, Representative Stepp, as Chris Curtis said, the fees here are to be set at cost. So in theory, there is not an excess flowing to the general fund. However, if it was a receipt service like the business license and corporation receipts, where it's set in statute at a rate and there's a cost of administering the program, and anything above and beyond that cost would lapse to the general fund as revenue to the general fund.
Okay, final follow-up. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Carpenter. So I guess that would beg the question then, since we are using a receipts fund change from the License Corp to, which is basically whatever they're paying for their fee structure, how do we just insert this $2.1 million without a corresponding fee change? Does that make sense? Like, I would assume if we're going to say we need $2.1 million more dollars in professional licensing fees, we would have to have a corresponding increase to generate that amount of revenue, through the chair.
Mr. Carpenter.
Yeah, through the chairman, Representative Stapp, the intent of this appropriation by the governor and I think the subcommittee is to lessen the required revenue from the professional licensees. So the UGF will go in to pay for investigations. The costs then required of the receipt revenue will be lower, and they will be able to lower the receipt fees.
Okay, and just one more quick clarification regarding that, Mr. Coacher.
Yes, follow-up. Rep. Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Coacher Justin, through the chair. So just so we're clear, and they can do that basically without legislative action, right, because of the statute? Uh-oh, I see a look from Ms. Curtis. That's my understanding. Through the chair. Question.
I'm not going to argue with Chris necessarily, but this is an appropriation from the legislature of money for a purpose. So with intention to lower fees. Even though the statute says you will do X, there is some precedence. I don't know the detail. I can't remember the details. There was some fiscal note money that was applied for the Board of Pharmacy in recent past. It wasn't a ton of money, but the intent was to lessen the cost on the professional licensees, and I know there's been some other attempts historically.
But this would be the legislature using its ultimate appropriation authority over the statutory structure.
Correct, Mr. Okay. Chairman.
I have Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Justison, through the chair. Was a request that if we get some additional information on line item number 5, those two new positions would be funded from CIP receipts. I just wanted to know if there was a projection on whether or not that would continue to be the case in future years with those FTE additions, or if there would be a potential that would ultimately burden GF.
Mr. Carpenter.
Yeah. through the chair, Representative Bynum, the intent here is to provide additional funding to manage these federal disaster grants. So the money is directly from these federal disasters. They're quite burdensome to manage, and they just needed additional positions that will be funded from those federal grants, which would, in theory, go away when the money's not available.
Quick follow-up. Rep. Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Through the chair. So the intention would be then to remove the two permanent positions when there's no more federal money available and or disasters that are currently ongoing. Is that the idea?
That sounds like an administrative answer.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, I don't know that for a fact, that there could be future federal disasters these positions would be needed for. They're not built into the budget as temporary increments. They're built in as permanent increments. Yeah.
Okay. So, Co-Chair, if we could just get some feedback on that for the future, that'd be great.
Well, okay, but this is one of those instances where I have to stop, look at my staff. I suppose we might have an opportunity that's a fairly narrow reason to bring back OMB, but I'll flag it. It's flagged with my staff, okay?
Just an email.
All right. Thank you. Could be email. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. And for the record, my understanding is, and I believe you were on the subcommittee for DCCED. With regards to item number 5, which was discussed in short, lots of opportunity for questions at that point. What I did hear was that there was some assumption that there would be more climate emergencies and things like that, disasters likely to come. And so there was some general understanding, I guess, that they felt like that would be worthy of a full-time position or two in order to administer the needs of those grants is what my understanding was from that conversation. But my question is really regarding number 10, because I understood that we had the opportunity to make a change, fund source change, because the fund source that was being used for this piece number 10 was what was considered at the time, I guess, not best practices in accounting. And I guess I wanted to understand that a little better and have that on the record so that we know a little bit about why we made a fund source change in the first place, or any, I guess the option could have been to just pull it off completely, but I wanted to hear any comments you might have about that. I know I've heard it from Mr. Painter, and I believe Mr. Carpenter may also have some words around kind of best practices of fund sourcing, if we could hear that for this item.
Okay. I just want to make sure. Are you asking him to relay what you and your committee thought?
What I understood him to tell us, yes.
Okay.
For the record.
Mr. Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this was originally, it's almost a two-part question. The first part was, did you want to provide relief to the professional licensees, which the subcommittee did want to do, to the amount of $2.1 million. The second part of the question was mostly technical, in that the governor proposed a fund source that was inactive from Ledge Finance's point of view. It was particularly a business license professional, business and corporation licensing code 1175, which we made inactive and replaced it with 1005 designated general GF program receipts. So the technical part there was use the right fund source, which would have been 1005. Okay, so then we moved to that and just say we're going to do that. Well, from Ledge Finance's point of view, you are then utilizing these program receipts from a program that is not related to professional licensing. Those receipts in that other program, as Representative Stapp said, lapse to the general fund when they're not utilized. They're entirely intended to run that program. Anything above and beyond that goes to the general fund. So by grabbing that fund source and using it for professional licensing, you're basically indirectly using a UGF, you're using a DGF fund code for a UGF purpose, and that's been the argument all along. So as Representative Galvin did in committee was to replace that and use directly UGF instead of this DGF code, which we would say is conflicts with the current budget practice anyway. And that was her point.
Okay. So the subcommittee, Mr. Carpenter, in your eyes, your agency's eyes, did it in a more straightforward, transparent way.
Correct, Mr. Okay. Chairman.
Any other questions? Okay, I don't see any. Any questions on the closeout of DCCED? Don't see any. I want to thank the three of you. So now we're going to go to the all-important agency, the legislature. Mr. Jang, stay with us. Looks like no, Mr. Ramon. Sorry, Mr. Jang, for that panic attack. Mr. Ramon Henderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ramon Henderson, staff to Representative Foster. The House Finance Subcommittee for the Office of the Governor adopted the BA report that you have in your packet with the forthcoming narrative. That narrative is now included with your packet as well. The subcommittee recommends the following operating budget for FY27, and I'll be using rounded numbers. For unrestricted UGF, $31 million. Other funds, $446,000. Federal funds, $158,000. Total funding, $32 million. Permanent full-time positions, 149. Permanent part-time positions, 1. Temp positions, 24, for a total of 174 positions. There were no amendments submitted to the Office of Governor's request for this budget, and there were no changes between the adjusted base and the governor's request. And basically, this is a status quo budget. The only thing that changed was the amount that was provided for salary adjustments.
Okay. So to be clear on the record, that was the Office of the Governor's budget, true?
Correct.
Okay. I had announced a different subcommittee. Any questions about the Office of the Governor's budget? Okay. All right. So now we're going to go to the legislature, and that is still your report, is it not?
That's correct.
Yes. We have a question from Rep. Allard.
Yeah. Just for clarification, did I just see an increase?
Pardon me?
Did I just see an increase on the governor's budget?
Through the chair, Representative Allen, no, there wasn't an increase from the FY27 adjusted base. The only change from FY26 to FY27 was salary adjustments.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, yeah. Chair.
All right. We'll consider that closed out if that formality is necessary, and we'll go to the legislature's closeout report. Mr. Henderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ramon Henderson. The subcommittee for the legislature's FY27 operating budget adopted the BA report that you have with the forthcoming narrative. That narrative is also included with the closeout documents. The subcommittee recommended the following as reflected in the BA report: unrestricted general funds, rounded $95 million, designated funds, $690,000, other funds, $286,000, total funding, $96 million. Permanent full-time positions, 298. Permanent part-time positions, 256. And temporary positions, 26, for a total of 580 positions. There were no amendments submitted for this budget during the subcommittee meetings. The subcommittee approved the legislative budget audit report and also approved the increases adopted by the Legislative Council. And the major increases adopted by the Legislative Council were $912,000 for travel, primarily for session per diem and staff relocation and lodging. $750,000 for to fund a special session. The funding used to be at a level of $1 million. Senate Finance cut the budget to $500,000. The governor vetoed $250,000, which left a budget of $250,000. So this $750,000 is to get the level of funding back up to the full $1 million. And there was also $855,000 for gavel-to-gavel session coverage to replace the loss of the federal funds. We lost those federal funding, so this UGF replaces that.
Okay. Questions? Rep. Allard.
Thank you. I'm just kind of curious, when we're giving this report, thank you, and through the chair, how come when we list permanent full-time positions, part-time, and temporary, how come we never list the vacant positions as a whole on there?
Because Mr. Henderson.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, because they're in the position count, so there could be some vacant positions included in that 298.
Okay.
full-time positions. There could be some vacant positions included in the part-time. We just don't separate them out.
May I do
and
a quick
and it's also I would say that it's at a point in time. Vacant positions today will not be the same as vacant positions maybe next month.
Okay.
Rep. Allard.
Thank you. Mr. Henderson, do you think maybe in the future, though, we could possibly look at putting that on that, just so we know as a body? That way I don't have to keep going back and asking how many vacant positions you have today. Can you tell me that?
I think this structure is historic and or recommended by alleged finance, which just isn't customarily done. Do you want to add anything to that, Mr. Henderson?
Through the chair, I think that if that's something that the committee would like to see in the future, that we could at least include the number of positions that are vacant at a point in time when the report is prepared.
Okay. That's great. And then I'll just start bringing my vacant book with me.
Understood.
All right, thank you.
So I think I'm going to Rep. Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair. A couple. First, I want to... Oh, look at this $35,000 increase in the lounge. What's that? What's that about? Receipts through the chair,
Mr. Henderson.
Through the chair, that's just to allow for the estimated anticipated increase in receipts from the lounge.
Quick follow up. I mean, it seems relatively extensive for the 40 of us to eat another $35,000 worth of stuff. Was that like an accounting issue with the lounge phones, or did they increase prices dramatically, or what?
Through the chair, this is receipt authority.
Okay, so in the event that they collect more, well, I will try to cut my meals down there for that purpose. Then, Mr. Co-Chair, I do have a follow up though, if I could.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Through the chair to Mr. Henderson, this 27,700 ledge council. What is that? Through the chair, item number two.
Mr. Henderson, looks like state facilities rent. Is that the item?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, that's just to align the level of expenditures, what they anticipate expenditures are going to be. They think that this is what the level of expenditure is going to be, and they need another $27,000.
Is that specifically, it says Ledge Council / Legislative State Facilities Rent. Is that on the rent side, or is that on the Ledge Council budget side through the chair? Do we know?
Mr. Henderson.
Through the chair, Mr. Representative Stapp, I believe that is the Legislature State Facilities Rent.
Okay. And last follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Last follow-up, Rep. Stapp for Mr. Henderson.
Yep. Thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair. Item number four, Gavel, Alaska. I mean, I think we all love that program. We're on it right now. But what is the loss of federal funding? What was that we lost that you mentioned through the chair?
Mr. Henderson.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I believe it was $855,000, but I'd bring up a lifeline to make sure that that's an accurate statement.
Lifeline?
Yes, looks like Mr. Painter or his delegate.
Ledge Council's here. Jessica Geary.
Okay. Ms. Geary, welcome.
Good afternoon. For the record, Jessica Geary, Executive Director, Legislative Affairs Agency. So I'm not entirely sure what the exact amount was of the federal funding that was lost, but basically Gavel to Gavel wouldn't be allowed to continue to operate and broadcast without us covering the cost. So this was their annual budget to operate Gavel to Gavel through the chair.
Thanks.
But it was related to some federal action, we think. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Yes, okay. The loss of federal funding.
Okay. Okay. I don't see any other questions on the legislature's budget, although I do now. Rep. Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. I just wanted to make a comment to the chair that during the subcommittee process that there were no amendments offered, but there were some suggestions for things that this body might or this finance committee might consider and that the House might consider as well, and that had to do with legislative staff pay. The two items that were brought up was specifically trying to bring parity between House staff and Senate staff on how we do pay. Okay. But more importantly, the second item that was mentioned and brought up was the idea that we would look at the staff stipends that they receive. We know that it is quite expensive for our staff to come and serve the Alaskan people by being here in Juneau, and that there are tremendous pressures on that moving expense plus the need for housing while they're here. I believe that stipend is quite low, and it was something that was discussed that it should be something we consider as we go through the finance process. So I just wanted to put those on the record that would be something that I would encourage us to talk about as we move forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you for that. Thank you, Ms. Geary and Mr. Henderson. We're going to go. Mr. Henderson, I think you're still with us on revenue.
Yes, but you might want to take some action on the legislature budget.
I'm sorry, what?
Are you going to take any action on the legislature's budget?
No.
Okay.
Not at this time.
All right. So Department of Revenue. Subcommittee for the Department of Revenue adopted the BA sheet that you have before you with the narrative forthcoming, which is also included in the closeout documents. And the subcommittee recommends the following funding and positions: $35 million UGF, unrestricted general funds, $3.5 million designated general funds, $336 million other funds, and that is primarily, or two-thirds of that is permanent fund gross receipts, and $110 million of federal funds for a total funding of $485.5 million. Permanent full-time positions, 825. Permanent part-time positions, 24. Temporary positions, 19, for a total of 868 positions. On this budget, the committee adopted all of the governor's requested items except for the following. We denied the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation request to create a single appropriation. This was included in the FY26 operating budget request by the department, and it was denied in that year as well. So we've maintained the structure that was set up, which is to have three separate appropriations, APFC investment management fees appropriation, the facilities rent non-state-owned appropriation, and the information technology and software licensing appropriation. The other action that was taken was to adopt one amendment to create a new appropriation called APFC Anchorage Operations, and a second amendment was adopted to delete the amount appropriated for the Anchorage lease cost of $34,000. The intent of both of these amendments was to clearly indicate the legislature's strong opposition to the opening of the Anchorage Permanent Fund Corporation and that it should be closed. And as Mr. Chairman, you pointed out during subcommittee, we can take that action, but if the Permanent Fund decides to keep that office open and provide funding to it, it raises a question about who has the authority, the legislature to appropriate money or the executive branch to do what they want to do. And that item, that can only be settled by my discussions with Ledge Legal, is that the only way that's ever going to be settled is by suit.
Okay.
So some of the other significant items that were adopted in this budget, keeping in mind that the Department of Revenue budget is about $35 million of UGF, and it's about 7% of their total funding. There was an increase of $91,000 between the FY27 adjusted base and the final request, and that's primarily as a result of the IT classification study and increased the cost of that. Some of the larger items, decrement was a $20 million PF gross receipt, Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation reduction, basically in their investment management fees. They also removed an investment operation analyst. There was an increment of $15.3 million for increased federal receipt authority. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation choice voucher program to uncover increased rents. Rents have gone up, and so there's additional federal funding for that. There was an increment of $860,000, Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation authority for incentive compensation. There's an increment of $737,000 to the Taxation Treasury Tax Division to add authority for an assistant chief economist and two commercial analyst positions for economic research and tax analysis. There was a $611,000 increase for the cost of recurring cloud server and data hosting charges for the new permanent fund dividend application system. There was a decrement of $227,000 to delete a long-term vacant state comptroller position. There was an increment of $345,000 is for the implementation of the classification study for the IT folks, and that's in various components throughout the department. There was an increment of $150,000 in the Taxation and Treasury Tax Division for funding for outside legal counsel services to assist with the due diligence pertaining to the Alaska Retirement Board and investments. The Department of Law does not have the expertise to do that, so there's outside counsel that's hired for that. There's an increment of $384,000 to add authority for increases to the firewall licensed in the Department of Revenue chargebacks, $307,000 increase for annual equipment costs for the Anchorage and the Juneau Data Center. And those are the major increases in that budget.
Okay, questions for Mr. Henderson on the Department of Revenue's subcommittee report closeout? I don't see any. Thank you very much, Mr. Henderson. That concludes the work of the House Finance Subcommittees. I want to thank the subcommittee chairs, the subcommittee aides, and our legislative fiscal analysts for all their hard work over the past 6 weeks. Many of their days, nights, and weekends were spent poring over the budgets of our state agencies and coordinating with departments to produce recommendations to this committee. This committee appreciates the due diligence throughout this process and your service to the state. We're now going to take a brief at ease, and we're going to resume the bill hearing in House Bill 280. We'll be at ease at 2:21.
Okay, we have one calling House Finance back to order at 2:27 p.m., Tuesday, March 10th. And we have one bill before the committee this afternoon, and that's House Bill 280. It's the digital tax bill. We'll hear invited testimony from three different industries. That is the telecom industry, the bankers, and the Motion Picture Association. And once we hear the invited testimony today, after that, then we will set the bill aside. So that will be our sole focus today. So first up, online, we have Scott Mackey from CTIA. That's the Wireless Association to testify for the Alaska telecommunications industry. So with that, Mr. Mackey, if you could please put yourself on the record, and if you could tell us a little bit about the language we have in our packets regarding the proposed amendment that deals with telecommunications.
Thank you, Chair Foster. For the record, my name is Scott Mackey. I'm testifying today on behalf of CTIA, the Wireless Association. CTIA, as I said, is the National Trade Association for the Wireless Industry. I'm testifying in support of an amendment to House Bill 280 that would provide special rules for wireless and other telecom providers for the sourcing, the sales of services, should the committee advance the House Bill 280 with a switch from cost of performance to market-based sourcing. Specifically, what the amendment would do is simply maintain the current cost of performance sourcing for services sold by wireless and other telecom companies. A couple of very brief points on that. First of all, many states, including Alaska, have modified the MTC apportionment rules in ways that fit their unique economic circumstances. In fact, a recent example on point to the very issue you're considering, the three states that have most recently switched from cost of performance to market-based sourcing have all included special rules for telecommunications providers. These states include Idaho in 2024 and both Kansas and Arkansas in 2025. When we're thinking about how the telecommunications industry operates and kind of what sourcing methodology best represents how telecom companies earn income from their networks, there are some similarities between transportation networks and communications networks. For instance, airlines. Airlines transport people and cargo over national and international networks with hubs in certain cities and employees, equipment, and network operations centers located in different areas throughout their entire network. Similarly, wireless companies and telecom companies transport information, packets of data, over national and international networks with assets, employees, and network operations centers spread across their networks as well. Therefore, we believe that cost of performance is the sourcing methodology that most fairly reflects how the industry earns its income. It's understandable that as the economy evolves into a more digital-based economy, that a lot of states, including Alaska, are looking to switch to market-based sourcing in order to ensure that companies that earn income selling services into a state, into a state's residents, but are not required to make significant or capital investments or employ state residents, make sure that they pay their fair share of income taxes. However, wireless and other telecom providers do and are making significant net investments in Alaska and employing Alaskans. And so the telecom industry continues to be one of the top industries in terms of domestic investment and capital investment in the United States. And under the three-factor system now in Alaska, the industry is paying income taxes through both the property and payroll factors in the Alaska Income Tax Code. Retaining cost of performance would keep the status quo for income taxes paid by wireless and other communications companies. This proposal is not about reducing what we currently pay. It would, however, prevent the imposition of additional tax burdens and significant negative financial statement impact in a time when the demands for capital investment on the industry are only growing, particularly on the wireless side, because consumers and businesses are dramatically increasing their use of wireless technologies that require us to continue to invest to be able to meet customers' needs for the increased bandwidth that's being used every year. So in summary, We respectfully request the adoption of an amendment to retain the current cost of performance sourcing rules, as we think they best reflect how the industry earns income in Alaska. This would continue to promote industry investment in Alaska while ensuring that the industry continues to fairly contribute to the tax revenues of the state. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and again, I appreciate this opportunity to answer any questions you might have.
Great, Chairman. Thank you very much, Mr. Mackey. We've got a question from Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Mr. Mackey, did you happen to listen into our last hearing when we heard from our Department of Revenue on this bill?
Mr. Mackey?
For the record, Scott Mackey again, through the chair, Representative Hannon. Yes, I did have an opportunity to listen to most of the hearing.
Okay, so follow up.
Representative Hannon?
The way I'm hearing you describe, in my recollection, I don't remember the Department of Revenue talking about the telecoms industry having a special apportionment as we do with the transportation industry, and there were a couple of others. But from being a payer of telecommunications services, I know that the industry is regulated by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And our Department of Revenue was briefing us on trying, you know, making sure we were aware of what any unintended consequences. And one of the conclusions was, in my mind, that we could carve out areas that we currently have corporate tax being paid under either a special apportionment or current regulatory structures. So my question to you is, would acknowledging the current regulatory structure and taxes that are being paid serve the same end as the extensive amendment that you are articulating?
Mr. Mackey?
For the record, Scott Mackey again, through the chair, Representative Hannon. If I understand your question, you're asking whether or not we are currently subject to special rules, and if we did not get this amendment, whether we would be subject to different rules and cost than market-based sourcing. And my understanding of the amendment is that telecom companies and other sellers of intangibles and services would all be subject to market-based sourcing regardless of the regulatory classification. Now, if there's special circumstances that contradict that, maybe you would want to pose that question to the Department of Revenue again, but my understanding is telecom would be treated the same as other businesses without this amendment if you switch to market-based sourcing.
Representative Hammond?
Representative Foster, I'm going to switch a little bit because, you know, I understand that you, Mr. Mackey, are reacting to the original version of the bill, and things, I think, are evolving on this, and we don't have a formal different version that addresses it, but I certainly heard sentiment leading me to conclude that we are attempting to keep our current corporate taxpayers paying taxes in the way they have been traditionally. One of the other areas the Department of Revenue spoke about was doing some of the amendments like the one that you're advocating for via regulation and reflecting it, tying it to the multi-state tax compact that exists. So, is the telecom industry currently satisfied with the multi-state tax compact's application of corporate taxation in the states that have gone to the multi-state tax compact for regulating telecom?
Mr. Mackey?
For the record, Scott Mackey again, through the chair, to Representative Hannon. We don't believe that we would be happy adopting the MTC rules for the general rules for moving from sourcing from cost of performance to sourcing of services. There are some special telecom rules that were adopted way back in 2008, but they don't really address this issue. And it is our feeling that without the statutory language to preserve the current treatment, that we would be moved. We don't think there's a way that it would be done on a regulatory basis because the proposed statutory amendment that I'm looking at in 280 would strike cost of performance altogether. So without that, we don't believe that the FTC rules would preserve the current treatment.
Okay, Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair to Mr. Mackey, thanks for being here. Okay, so just to simplify, the first question is going to be, basically you are objecting to changing to market-based sourcing for the telecom communication industry. So you, the amendment basically would allow us to keep treating telecommunications as cost of performance. Is that correct, through the chair?
Mr. Mackey?
For the record, Scott Mackey again, through the chair, to the representative. Yes, that's correct.
Fault, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Staff.
Yeah, I think Co-Chair Foster through the chair to Mr. Mackey. Okay, so I'm reading the reason why, and I guess maybe you can articulate a specific example. So if basically cost of performance is where the sale actually takes place for the infrastructure that, or excuse me, where the cost of actually performing the good takes place as opposed to where the sale actually takes place. So I read the analogy you have, ChatGPT, that type of stuff, but I don't quite understand in a monetary sense. So can you give me like a simple example of what kind of the issue is for using market-based sourcing for telecommunications would be through the chair?
Mr. Mackey?
For the record, Scott Mackey, again through the chair, for the representative. So the fundamental premise is that under the current statute, where the preponderance of the cost of providing of earning the income occurs, is the state where the sales would be sourced. So in the case of telecommunications networks that are across the country, the cost of marketing, the cost of the network engineering, the network operations center that are located in the mainland U.S., where a lot of the actual work goes in terms of maintaining the network security. Under Alaska law currently, the preponderance of the cost of providing the service are happening in those other states, so therefore the sales just from the sale of services, not from things like phones and tangible personal property, which all are sourced to the location of the customer. But for the services, they would be sourced to other states and not to Alaska.
Okay, follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Staff.
Yeah, I mean, look, I understand. So, okay, this is net-based tax, right? So if you are incurring costs to provide a service in the state of Alaska, my assumption would be you are apportioning those costs based on net profits to a customer in the state of Alaska. So I don't see why it would be that big of a deal to count the sale at the location it takes place as opposed to the costs that you're incurring, because it's net-based income, right? I mean, you're still apportioning those net-based costs, whether they're taking place in Virginia or Texas, to your net profitability in a sale in Alaska. Wouldn't that be true through the chair?
Mr. Mackey?
Well, for the record, Scott Mackey again through the chair to the representative. So under the current law, the state that unless the preponderance of the cost of providing those services are in Alaska, the sales aren't sourced to Alaska. So we would still source the portion of our income under the three-factor formula would look at the total amount of property, plant, and equipment in Alaska versus the total property, plant, and equipment everywhere, and that factor would go to Alaska, as would the total payroll. But under the current law that we would like to retain, because the preponderance of the cost of providing the services where we're earning the income on sales to Alaska or not in Alaska, those receipts would not be sourced to the state.
Okay, Fault.
Representative Staff.
So second portion, the part two of this, the change in the amendment says the income-producing activity is performed both in and outside the state, and a greater proportion of the income-producing activity is performed in this state than in any other state based on cost of performance, right? So, like, we have telecom communication companies like AT&T. They have performed stuff in the state, but the vast majority of the money that they perform, if you were looking at cost of performance, they do outside the state. So how would I handle that if I were to continue to cost of performance-based market-based sourcing through the chair?
Mr. Mackey?
For the record, Scott Mackey, again through the chair, it would be handled the exact same way it is today under current law, under the three-factor apportionment formula with cost of performance. The sales would be allocated outside of Alaska. The property and payroll factors would be proportionately allocated to Alaska, and the resulting fraction would be the fraction of the income that's proportioned to Alaska for tax purposes.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Kocher.
Follow up.
Yeah, thank you. What's the harm to your business if I apportion the sales to Alaska as well?
Mr. Mackey.
For the record, Scott Mackey again through the chair. The harm would be that our taxes would go up, for one. And secondly, because when states make changes to tax policy that affect future tax liabilities, there's a financial statement impact to the companies due to the fact primarily that when there's a difference between a tax depreciation and book depreciation that gets recovered later on when an asset's placed in service. And so what would happen in this instance is an asset that was placed in service with accelerated depreciation, in the future, that income would be added back to recover that expense. And so if in the future we pay a higher tax rate, then under the Financial Accounting Standards Board tax rules, the entire impact of that, all those future years of tax, deferred tax liabilities would need to be recognized in the quarter that the state enacts a change. And so it would be a financial statement hit to companies doing business in multiple states that would reflect the negative future tax implications of the change.
Follow up, Mr. Kocher.
Follow up?
Yeah, I think Kocher Voss for the chair. Okay. Basically, what you built all your stuff in Washington and Texas for a reason because of the nature of the structure, because of the way you incur costs, and that's how you want to apportion. Okay, that actually makes a lot of sense for me, so thanks for doing that. So my last question is, how many other states that have gone to market-based sourcing have allowed this exemption to cost of performance for telecom industry through the chair?
Mr. Mackey?
For the record, Scott Mackey again through the chair. So I mentioned the three states, Kansas, Arkansas, and Idaho. There are also California, Nebraska, and the last one is Tennessee. All of those states that have moved from cost of performance to market have adapted rules that allow cost of performance to continue for telecommunications providers.
Follow up, Mr. Kocher.
Follow up?
Yeah. So that's 5 out of the 40. Why didn't the other 35 states do it through the chair?
Mr. Mackey?
Those states use market-based sourcing. Oh, I'm sorry. For the record, Scott Mackey, again, through the chair, to the representative, those states use market-based sourcing.
Yeah, let me clarify, Mr. Kocher.
Follow up?
Yeah, through the chair to Mr. Mack. No, I appreciate the fact that you gave me 5 states, but I think we're closer to 35 states are using market-based sourcing. So my question would be, why not 30 out of the 35-ish or so that have switched from cost of performance to market-based sourcing? Why would the rest of the states not give you the carve-out to maintain cost of performance through the chair?
Mr. Mackey?
For the record, Scott Mackey again through the chair. I can't answer the motivations of those states. I would just say that you're accurate in your description.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, do we have any further questions for Mr. Mackey before we move over to the bankers and the motion picture? I don't see any. So with that, Mr. Mackey, thank you so very much for being available to answer questions regarding the telecom industry. We are next going to move over to... let's see here. Karen Boucher from the Financial Institution State Tax Coalition on behalf of the Alaska Bankers Association. Ms. Boucher, if you could please put yourself on the record and give us your thoughts.
Thank you, Chair Foster. For the record, I'm Karen Boucher, Managing Member of the Institution State Tax Coalition.
Ms.
Boucher, it is understandable that the Alaska Division of Taxation misinterpreted the multi-state tax concept and UDIPTA as they relate to financial
Ms. Boucher?
Because it is a very narrow
Ms. Boucher?
Law.
Ms. Yes? Boucher? We're having a hard time hearing you. I don't know if maybe you're on a speakerphone or something. Is there anything you can switch up just to get some better reception?
Okay, I've taken myself off of speaker. Is this better?
It is a little better, and if you could maybe get a little closer to the mic, sure appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Foster. For the record, I'm Karen Boucher, Managing Member of the Financial Institution State Tax Coalition. It is understandable that the Alaska Division of Taxation misinterpreted the Multi-State Tax Compact and UDIPTA as they relate to financial institutions because it is a very narrow aspect of state tax law. I was only allocated 10 minutes, so first I will focus on the top two issues we have with comments that were made by the Division of Taxation. First, Mr. Spanos said that the state would lose revenue if it adopted the industry proposals because the division would instead start with the Multi-State Tax Commission regulations. Our proposal is to adopt the same provision via statute. So if the division says it would adopt via regulation the same provisions we are proposing, there cannot be any revenue loss. Moreover, we believe that there would be a revenue increase for the state because we are proposing adopting a broad definition of financial organization to include entities that derive more than 50% of their receipts in competition with banks and entities more than 50% owned by financial institutions. So this broad group of entities would be attributing to the state the interest they charge to Alaska residents, therefore apportioning more income to Alaska. Second, Mr. Manos said that the division can issue special industry regulations under UDIPTA. He's right. For all industries other than financial organizations and public utilities, which are carved out of UDIPTA. Current Alaska statute requires corporations to adopt their apportion their income under the Multi-State Tax Compact or as provided by this chapter. And currently, that chapter does not include any apportionment provisions for financial institutions. The Multi-State Tax Compact was drafted in 1966, and the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act, or UDIPTA, was incorporated into that compact. UDIPTA was drafted in 1957, at a time when national banks were much smaller, and state banks were not permitted to cross state lines. UDIPTA specifically says that entities other than financial organizations and public utilities shall apportion income as provided in this article. So it is clear that UDIPTA does not apply to apportion the income of a bank. With respect to the division's authority to issue special industry regulations, UDIPTA essentially provides that if the apportionment provisions of this article do not fairly represent the extent of a taxpayer's business in the state, the division can issue special industry regulations. But as previously mentioned, this article does not apply to the apportionment of banks. So the division is not authorized by the legislature to issue special apportionment regulations for banks. In 1994, the Multi-State Tax Commission, or MTC, adopted model statutory language for the apportionment of income for financial institutions. This was drafted as a model of statutory language because the MTC realized that states that had merely adopted the compact had not statutorily given their departments of revenue legislative authority to issue apportionment provisions for banks. The MTC model provisions include market sourcing and were updated in 2015. The model was the MTC's most successful uniformity project. It was adopted by more than 23 states and approximately half of those states needed to adopt it via statute rather than regulation. We believe Alaska is among those states that need to statutorily give the division authority to adopt special apportionment provisions for banks. And we would be pleased to discuss these technical issues with members of the Division of Taxation and staff of representatives on this committee. Now I need to move to the need for a broad definition of financial organization and the receipts definition under the MTC model apportionment provisions for financial institutions. In 2014, the MTC rewrote the UDPTA provisions to narrow the definition of receipts and to provide market sourcing provisions. As previously noted, UDPTA does not apply to financial institutions. Instead, the MTC model for financials provide a receipts definition and sourcing provisions. Thus, it was never the intent of the MTC to apply the UDPTA narrow receipts factor definition to financials. Under that narrow definition, which is included in HB 280, sales related to lending and to hedging and security transactions are excluded from the sales factor. Thus, under that definition, interest from loans or credit cards to Alaska residents would not be attributed to the state. The receipts that are excluded from the sales factor can exceed more than 50% of a bank's receipts and would reduce the income taxed by Alaska. We would prefer certainty and uniformity among the states. Accordingly, our request is that the statute provide that financial institutions apportion their income as provided in the MTC model, which does not include that narrow sales definition. With respect to the definition of financial organization, HB 280 currently defines a financial organization as a bank or a handful of other traditional financial organizations that were around in the 1950s. The MTC model broadly defines financial institution to include bank holding companies, banks, entities more than 50% owned by bank holding companies, numerous other regulated financial organizations, and other entities that derive more than 50% of receipts in competition with banks. Large financial institutions may have several hundred subsidiaries involved in their banking business, and it is important that we have certainty that all of the more than 50% owned entities fall under the same apportionment provisions. The broad definition also will provide more revenue for the state because with the compacts current or proposed, in this bill, the limited definition of financial organization and the narrow sales definition, a non-bank that issues loans or credit cards to Alaska residents will not attribute that interest income to the state. Additional reasons for wanting the financial apportionment provisions to be identified in the statute are financial reporting purposes and estimated tax payment purposes. Public companies are required to file quarterly reports with the SEC and to report their earnings. In determining earnings, all expenses, including state taxes, are taken into consideration. In the quarter in which the tax law changes are enacted, public companies are required to determine the impact on their current year's taxes, as well as to revalue their deferred tax assets. If the statute provides that financial institutions apportion their income as provided in the MTC model using a broad definition, then financial institutions will know how to compute the income and balance sheet's impacts of a law change, and also how to calculate the required Alaska quarterly tax payments so they are not charged statutory penalty and interest for underpayments. Without something being included in the statute, we don't know how sales are going to be defined, how they're going to be sourced, and whether our subsidiaries will ultimately be required to apply different apportionment provisions. Yes, large corporations have sophisticated tax departments, but without having that information, we would only be able to guess what the resulting tax impacts can be. My last comment is that if the committee feels that adding the 15 or so pages of text to the bill is too much, it could be accomplished, this, you know, the same could be accomplished by inserting a paragraph that essentially says financial institutions are to apportion their income using the same formula as general corporations, and the division is to modify the financial institution apportionment regulation to adopt the MTC model's broad definition in sales and sourcing provisions. Thank you for the opportunity to provide this testimony.
Thank you so very much. Ms. Boucher, we do have a question from Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I'm just going to request that Ms. Boucher send your summary paragraph that you suggested at the very end, as opposed to the 15-page amendment. So if you could send that to Chair Foster's office, I am sure his staff would be appreciative versus trying to listen to it on the record.
Okay. And I think, let's see, do we have another question? Representative Stapp?
Yeah, thank you. Co-Chair Foster, through the chair, thank you for the very technical, detailed explanation. I would just say, so basically what I am hearing is the problem of the sales definition is in basically the denominator of the fraction. We are your take is the denominator is being artificially inflated by things that are actually not sales. Is that a good way of putting it through the chair?
Ms. Boucher?
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, I did not hear the question. It was too static.
Representative Stapp?
Yeah. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair to Ms. Boucher. I'm trying to kind of simplify the argument on the sales and why we need the definition. It is basically that the denominator is being inflated through things that are not technically accountable transactions to the sale. So basically what you're saying is based on the definition of sales, we're artificially inflating the denominator. Is that a good way of putting it through the chair?
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, no, it is not being inflated. What we are saying is if you look at the narrow definition that is part of UDIPTA, it excludes from sales interest and other activities that are part of a bank's business. And therefore, okay, it would be excluded from the apportionment. We don't think that is appropriate to take a bank's business and exclude a large portion from the apportionment. One of the reasons that causes us issue is if it's excluded from apportionment, we then end up with an audit from the Department of Revenue who takes a look and says, well, this can't be right because so little of your income is included in the apportionment.
Follow-up? Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. Okay, I had it backwards then. That actually makes more sense because that's just a way of artificially inflating the liability than if you're excluding actual transactions. Thanks.
Do we have any further questions? Okay, seeing none, Ms. Boucher, really appreciate your being available. We're going to go to our last invited testifier, and that is Ms. Melissa Patak. She's the Vice President of the Motion Picture Association. Ms. Patak, if you could put yourself on the record.
Yes, thank you very much, Co-Chair Foster and members of the committee. This is Melissa Patak. I'm Vice President of State Government Affairs with the Motion Picture Association. Thank you very much for the opportunity to provide additional testimony. I appeared before your committee several weeks ago, so I don't want to take too much time, but just want to reiterate that consistent with market sourcing, which is about taxing on the basis of the location of the customer, for broadcast and cable networks, we would like that same formula, customer location, to be applied and to be added as an amendment to this bill. I did also have the opportunity to listen to the last hearing, and I know there is an intent to possibly address this in regulation, which we appreciate, but we would always prefer to have the clarity of the statute. And we would ask that you take this amendment in the bill. The other question I think that was raised is about revenue. And while I don't have a precise or exact amount of revenue, a revenue impact this amendment would have, I know and I can say with confidence that using the customer location apportionment formula for broadcast and cable networks will not significantly or appreciably change the Department of Revenue's estimate on additional revenue. In other words, this is not going to be some big amount that is not going to be realized in terms of extra revenue to Alaska. We do not believe that it would appreciably change that revenue estimate. I'm happy to take questions. I have more I could say, but I know many of you are familiar with this issue, and I don't want to take up time unnecessarily.
Okay, thank you very much. We do have a question, Representative Galvin.
Thank you, through the chair. I believe last time we heard you speaking on the 18th, or maybe it was someone from your organization. I think that I heard that there were 40 or... I can't read my writing. It either says 40 or 20 other states who have adopted some sort of consistency for broadcasters. I think you were looking for a consistent approach, and I just wanted to hear what that number is for the record.
Ms. Yes. Patek.
That number, thank you very much. And to the chair, thank you, Representative Galvin, for the question. That number is 14.
Thank you.
14 is the number of other states that have adopted. That includes Idaho, Missouri, Rhode Island, Tennessee, Iowa, Illinois, Michigan, Louisiana, North Carolina, Kentucky, Florida, Texas, West Virginia, and Wisconsin.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster and Ms. Pataki. I attempted to get an answer to this question the last time you appeared telephonically with us, so I'm hoping that because my knowledge has grown about this bill and perhaps you've come to understand that simplifying things is good when trying to communicate complex topics to a citizen legislature. I want to focus very specifically on the advertisement element. The advertisers who are buying an advertisement that is then broadcast in Alaska, and it appears to me that the proposed language in your amendment gives the apportionment of the revenue an advertiser is paid to their home state, wherever that the advertiser. So for lack of a better example, let's say it is a nationally broadcast football game with a beer commercial, and that the commercial that beer seller has advertised is paid in the home state of them, not where it's broadcast to. Is that correct?
Ms. Patek?
Yes, and through the chair, thank you for that question. Yes, that is correct. It is the location of, in this case, the beer company. That is the customer of the broadcast network that is, showing the football game. The contract is between that network and that beer company. And so, yes, it would be apportioned and sourced to the state where that beer company is located, correct?
One follow-up.
Representative Hannon.
And of the 14 states that you described earlier that are doing a location method of apportionment, are any of them able to capture revenue off of advertiser subscriptions that aren't located in their state, or they've all apportioned it to the state where the... the corporate headquarters for the purchased advertiser is?
Thank you for the question. And through the chair, you mentioned you put in subscribers and advertisers, so there's two things there. I'm going to just keep with the advertisers. Yes, in those 14 states, the apportionment is on the location of the advertiser. And some of those states do have companies that are based in their states. But a state like Idaho might be comparable to a state like Alaska. It probably doesn't have a lot of national advertisers, yet they have moved to this apportionment formula on the basis of the location of the customer, which is the advertiser.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions for Ms. Patak? I don't see any. I think that's everything for today then, and so just wanted to give folks an opportunity to have another word on the proposed language. I don't have anything else to come for us today, and if there's nothing else from the committee, that concludes our meeting, and our next scheduled meeting is for tomorrow morning. That's March 11th at 9 a.m., and at that meeting, we'll be rolling out the next committee substitute for the operating budget and the mental health budget. So if there's nothing else to come for the committee, we'll be adjourned at 3:08 p.m. Thank you.